On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will look at redistricting efforts, a proposal to create a nonpartisan system, and what to expect once the 2020 federal census data is in. First, though, let's discuss Governor Evers' call for a special session of the legislature to expand Medicaid. Wisconsin is one of a dozen states that has not adopted expansion under the Affordable Care Act. That's the Kaiser Family Foundation keeping track. Republicans who control the legislature have repeatedly rejected Democrats' push for Medicaid expansion, but the governor said Thursday this time is different.
This time, if we don't expand Badger Care, then we're not just missing out on the opportunity to expand access to quality, affordable health care. We're also missing out on an additional $1 billion under the American Rescue Plan.
Do you support Medicaid expansion in Wisconsin? Are you on Badger Care? Have you heard of projects that the additional federal funds would support? It's 800-642-1234. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief. He co-hosts the WPR Politics Podcast. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, Kate.
Good morning. So the governor is making a go again at Medicaid expansion. What is his approach this time?
So his approach this time is to basically reframe what he put in his budget that Republicans already took out of the budget, in the budget committee process. So what he did is he introduced that as a bill. And as part of that bill, he said, you know, all that federal money that Wisconsin would get by expanding Badger Care, here is what it would be spent for. So there is this additional $1 billion that Wisconsin would qualify for this year that was set aside for states that have not yet taken the federal expansion of Medicaid. And so, you know, between that and the, you know, increased federal payments for Medicaid that Wisconsin would get for expanding Badger Care, the state would be looking at about $1.6 billion in increased federal funding. The governor's saying, let's take that $1 billion sweetener payment that is a one-time payment that is basically just money from the federal government, and let's spend it for these very specific projects so that you can have an idea of what that $1 billion means and what this expansion would mean.
So projects in lawmaker districts, what are some of these big ticket items attached to the governor's proposal?
So some of them are, you know, pretty narrow projects, very specific projects. Some of them are more broad. You know, there's $100 million to replace lead pipes, $200 million to expand broadband, $100 million for bridge and local roads. There's $50 million for the Verso paper mill in Wisconsin Rapids. There's, you know, down to $4 million for a hospital in Darlington. A long list of dozens of projects that would get this funding.
Another is $150 million in putting toward the rainy day fund.
Yeah, and so that's an example that's not, you know, a specific project, say, but it would be taking this and, you know, setting aside a part of it for potential budget shortfalls in the future.
I was listening to Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke saying, you know, if the governor were serious about the proposals he packed into this bill, he could, fund each of them today with the mountain of federal funds at his direct disposal. Is that the sentiment from Republican lawmakers?
I think that is one of the things that you've heard from them is, you know, Wisconsin is getting, like other states, getting a lot of federal funding, quite a bit of it at Governor Evers' discretion that could potentially be used for these projects. In fact, some of the funding we know is going toward broadband. The governor already said he laid out $100 million in grants for broadband. So some of that is going to happen. And it's possible that some of these projects would receive or will receive funding from that, you know, allotment of federal funds that was part of the latest stimulus bill. But obviously that's not the way the governor is framing this. And so he's trying to say this Medicaid expansion equals these projects.
We're talking with Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, as we look at the governor's call for a special session tomorrow on Medicaid expansion. Do you support Medicaid expansion in our state? Are you on Badger Care? Would you qualify if the program were to expand? 800-642-1234. Troy is joining us from Muskego. Hi, Troy.
Hello. I just think that the main reason why the Republicans are not for expanding it is because their donors, which a lot of them are capitalists, and a lot of those donors own insurance companies, and the insurance companies don't want anybody to anything that looks like we're going to socialized medicine or universal healthcare, because then they can't exploit the middle class for ridiculous premiums or whatever. They want the power. So that's the real reason why the Republicans are declining to expand Medicare for all. Expanding on Medicare.
Troy, thanks. Sean, why do Republican lawmakers oppose expanding Medicaid coverage?
So this came up in the budget committee a few weeks ago when they pulled the proposal out of the budget. I think it boiled down to a few arguments from Republicans. One, they refer to Medicaid, the expansion of Medicaid, as expansion of welfare, and they say they don't want to do that. They say that they don't want to, increase federal funding just because that's federal tax dollars. It comes from somewhere. And then they also talk about they like the system that Wisconsin has, where everybody up to 100% of the federal poverty level has access to Badger Care, whether you're a parent or you don't have kids, you have access to Badger Care up to 100% of the federal poverty level. And then between 100 and 138% of the federal poverty level, which is the group we're talking about here with this, that expansion.
Yeah.
That group can, in theory, purchase insurance on the federal marketplace. And so then you are going through the private insurance system, in an indirect way. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's the system that they have promoted in the past. They're under Governor Walker, there was an effort to kind of buy down the premiums a bit for that system. And that's something that they have definitely promoted. The counter argument you hear for that is that, practically speaking, somebody who's making that much money has a hard time affording the premiums for, that level of insurance.
So the governor calls a special session set for tomorrow. What might happen?
I think if you look at what happened in the previous special sessions that Governor Evers has called, not much is going to happen. In fact, Republicans said as much last week in a statement they released. They're going to gavel it shut, basically. When you hear that a governor has called a special session, it sounds like he's calling the full legislature in to discuss something, and it gives the impression that the full legislature will meet and debate this bill that the governor has presented. But they don't have to do that. I mean, what they have done under Governor Evers is they come in. It doesn't even necessarily have to be a legislator who does it. It could be legislative staff in some cases. In the Senate, I think they may have done that. They come in, they gavel open the session, say the special session is convened, and then they can just gavel it closed and say it's over. And so they've given every indication that that's what they plan to do with this one.
Is this a completely shut issue for Democrats? Are there any openings here for negotiation?
I guess you would say that there might be. It's a popular issue, mm-hmm. and you have seen expansion happen in other states. So, there have been openings there. If you look at the statements from legislative leaders, though, and there were statements out from the Assembly Speaker, the Assembly Majority Leader, the Senate President, the Senate Majority Leader, the co-chairs of the Budget Committee, they all said in unequivocal terms that they're not doing this. So, that makes it sound like this session, it's not going to happen. But, it's because it's politically popular, still something the governor's willing to push.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief as we discuss what's moving in the legislature. Moving on to redrawing political boundaries, what questions do you have about the redistricting process? How do you think Wisconsin's legislative maps should be redrawn? Can it be fair and transparent? How? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, we're getting up to speed on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So now to redistricting, when once a decade, the state uses the new federal census data to redraw political boundaries for congressional and legislative districts. Democratic lawmakers, they have a bill to give the power to a nonpartisan board to draw the maps. So how do you think the redistricting process will play out? How would you go about making it fair? What will redistricting mean for the next decade of Wisconsin politics? Join in 800-642-1234. WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson stays with us. So, Sean, redistricting, new census data, explain where Wisconsin is at in this high-stakes process of redrawing political boundaries.
We're kind of in a holding pattern right now, like other states, because there was a delay in the census because of COVID-19.
Yep.
And so the data that we get from the census to redraw political maps is slower coming out this year than it normally would be.
Okay.
And so I think they're looking at like August or so for getting that, the real detailed census data that is the building blocks of political maps.
Yeah. How does that census data parlay into actual, lines on a map and redrawing these districts?
Well, once that data is available and you have fine details of all these census blocks throughout the state, then, the people who make these maps, who are mathematical wizards and, have computer programs to kind of do their bidding, basically, they will use that to create alternative maps. You'll have somebody for Republicans doing it, somebody for Democrats doing it. You'll have somebody for the governor's People's Maps Commission working on map alternatives. Once that data is out there, they can get really precise and specific with drawing these lines.
And meanwhile, there are the courts, there are the lawmakers, there are the attorneys at the ready. Explain what you saw at the Supreme Court recently, rejecting a petition about redistricting.
This was a petition by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, a conservative advocacy or conservative law firm, I guess you could say, group in Wisconsin. If there's a conservative cause here, a Republican cause here, they often have a hand in it. And so their petition was to basically require lawsuits involving redistricting to proceed immediately to the state Supreme Court. As soon as there's a lawsuit, it would basically be locked in to the court as the venue. And
the high court,
that's
the
how
venue.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Supreme Court. Yeah, the state Supreme Court would be the venue. So there would not be any kind of dabbling around in lower courts. And in theory, I'm not sure that a state could have totally blocked a federal court from getting involved. But I think the idea was that this would have discouraged federal panels from potentially taking a redistricting challenge if they knew there was already something pending in the state Supreme Court and that Wisconsin had this rule where that's how redistricting proceeds. What happened, though, was that our state Supreme Court, which has a 4-3 conservative majority, issued not really a decision. This was a rules petition, and they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to be the automatic court where these challenges go. There were provisions in this proposal from Will that would have let the court draw a map based on alternatives that came forward from the governor and the legislature. You heard certain justices on the court when this was up for a hearing, Patience Rogensack, one of the conservatives, saying, we don't want to get in that business.
Or and even so, if we wanted to, we don't have the ability to do this.
Right. It will put a lot of focus on on them if that's what happens. So they rejected the petition, but you know, it's important to note cases could still end up before the state Supreme Court when it comes to redistricting. You know, the justices even said, we reserve the right to take these cases through a regular appeal process or through an original action, you know, where somebody petitions the court directly. The court says we can do this. It's just not going to be the rule that we have to do this.
We're talking with Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the process of redistricting, what's happening in the courts. How do you think Wisconsin's legislative map should be redrawn? Which factors should decide where district lines ultimately land? Join in 800-642-1234. So, Sean, a pair of Democratic lawmakers have pushed for a map-drawing process that removes lawmakers. Can you explain this approach?
It's a lot like Iowa, which has had this approach for a few decades now, where the maps are drawn by professionals at a nonpartisan agency. In Wisconsin, it would be the Nonpartisan Legislative Reference Bureau. We often, in shorthand, it's like the legislature's attorneys, but not like the private attorneys that they hire for, you know, a lawsuit on policy grounds. These are like the people who help them draft bills. And I think it's very fair to apply the nonpartisan label to those agencies because they work tirelessly to live up to it. So this plan would have the Legislative Reference Bureau draw these maps, and they would really be limited in what they can look at when they're drawing the maps. They would not be looking at election results or anything like that. They'd be looking at making them the districts roughly equal in population, you know, adhere to the Federal Voting Rights Act, the traditional redistricting criteria. Mm-hmm. And then once they do that, once they come up with a map, they would present it to the legislature, and the legislature would have a chance to vote it up or down. You know, they wouldn't be able to amend it. You know, when you're talking about amending a map, you're talking about changing the district lines. So they wouldn't be able to do that. It would be an up or down vote. If they voted down, it would go back to the Reference Bureau. They'd do it again, and the process would go repeat a second time, to the point where eventually the legislature would have the map in, you know, an amendable phase where they could change it, but they'd have to get, I think, a 3/5 vote to change it. So it would be very hard to do, and it would require broad bipartisanship to do that. So there's all sorts of kind of stopgaps in this bill to prevent partisan people from, carrying out their partisan wishes.
And the governor had wanted to go with the People's Maps Commission, or making it a very public process. What is the status of that?
The People's Maps Commission is a little bit different, and they held meetings virtually, you know, last year with a focus on different congressional districts, but over Zoom. Mm-hmm. And so what the People's Maps Commission is now in the process of doing is drawing its alternatives, you know, its maps. And so one of the things that they are going to look at is they're going to look at those traditional redistricting criteria. Make sure that the districts are equal and population is kind of a biggie. One of the things that they're going to look at, though, that is different is that they are going to prioritize maps that emphasize, or I guess reflect, partisan fairness. Mm. So what does that mean? They're going to look for maps that reflect what Wisconsin looks like in statewide elections. And you know, look at the last 5 years, which is what they would be looking at for statewide election results. We've had a couple of presidential elections decided here by about 20,000 votes, about as close as they come. So they would be saying a map that kind of reflects that would be something that we would prioritize more than a map that is more lopsided.
Sounds like litigation is imminent. In the last few seconds, how are Republicans preparing for lawsuits?
Well, I mean, everything is in kind of the early going right now. And right now there's a lawsuit over lawyers, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republicans had hired private attorneys. A Democratic attorney in Madison, Lester Pines, sued, and I mean, his firm did, said you can't have lawyers on standby when there's no redistricting case yet. And that argument won the day at circuit court in Dean County, you know, the first challenge. A judge said, yeah, actually, that's correct, and said, you know, you can't have attorneys right now on standby for redistricting. So Republicans are appealing that, and that's kind of the status of things right now, is they, as of this moment, are not allowed to have these attorneys on standby. But you can bet whatever the case, once redistricting cases are happening, you know, there's going to be a lot of attorneys involved.
Sean, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Kate.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Madison area Representative Francesca Hong is here. We'll pick it up with her after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Across the country, restaurant jobs remain well below pre-COVID staffing levels, and staffing up for a big summer season will be a challenge. That's forecasting from the National Restaurant Association. Do you work in a restaurant? How have you managed in the pandemic? Are you back at work? What's changed? 800-642-1234. Democratic Representative Francesca Hong represents a Madison district and was elected to the Assembly last year. She's a chef who co-owns Morris Ramen in Madison. Representative Hong, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. What are your impressions now in the legislature? What are your impressions so far on how it operates?
I'm not quite sure how well it's operating, but I'm very much grounded in the community work that's going on. Have a much more profound respect for all of our local government leaders, and really just trying to do my best to make sure that as many voices are heard in the Capitol as I can.
You know, including your voice, a question we've posed to all the newly first-term lawmakers recently is, do you feel welcome in the State House by other lawmakers? Do you feel like you have a voice, or do you have to fight to be heard?
I do feel welcomed by quite a few of my colleagues, but I also feel very discriminated against by others. I think that being a woman of color, navigating different spaces, you have to sometimes think if this is some place where I have to focus more on my gender, or do I have to focus more on my race? And that doesn't change just because I'm working in the Capitol. I'm thankful to go in with a very strong freshman class. We've got a great sense of camaraderie, and we are very supportive of one another, as well as members of the caucus. I will say that I've experienced both racism and sexism, and it's unfortunate, but a reality for many women of color that navigate both professional and personal spaces.
You've experienced racism and sexism. Would you, you know, care to elaborate at all?
Not at this time. I think a lot of it can be seen were microaggressions, but they're conversations that I hope that I can continue to have and really make sure to, you know, let folks know that this type of behavior won't be tolerated, but that I want to speak more with action and make sure that other voices are heard as well.
You have a background working in restaurants, co-owning a restaurant. Do you feel that the interests of service employees are clearly represented in the legislature?
No, because I don't think those who represent service workers would say that workers need to, I think they're framing it very poorly. And instead of recognizing that we have a crisis in not in worker shortage, but in wages, that, you know, to say that the Wisconsin workforce is not doing everything in their power to try to go back to work, it's insulting, it's discriminatory. And to be perfectly honest, I have colleagues in the legislature who continue to punish poor people and incentivize the rich. And that's not how we move this state forward.
How would you go about moving forward with a mind on who are, you know, frontline workers who are maybe minimum wage? What do you see as the path forward to supporting these type of workers?
we must increase the minimum wage. It's been over 12 years. The living wage right now, with the increasing the workforce, we should be at closer to $24 an hour. All workers have a right to collectively bargain. All right, workers have a right to voice their opinion in the workplace. And really, if you think about it, the management, the operations of our workforce is most dependent on the workers. They're key to any sort of workforce ecosystem. And if we want to keep that ecosystem strong, if we want a stronger economy, all focus needs to be on care and rights of our workers.
Restaurant and bar employees have been some of the hardest hit economically. What are you hearing from your colleagues in the industry about how they're doing?
It's, you know, many of those who lost their work, lost their jobs in the service industry, weren't able to apply for unemployment. The Wisconsin unemployment system is one of the most difficult to navigate. And when you're working many different part-time jobs for different businesses, it becomes even more challenging. And so for those who have been suffering, who have been trying to find work, who have been trying to find benefits for the past year, to now be further insulted by saying that this is a workforce shortage, it's really difficult, and it makes it difficult to continue to operate businesses when we have a workforce, when we have workers who have been treated so poorly in the past. And so what I think we need really is a collective reimagining, and knowing that the system has been broken for quite some time. And as an employer, you can look at cutting costs by being able to not having high turnover, by caring for your workers, by making sure that not only do they have a living wage, but they have access to benefits and other resources. And we need to make sure to level the playing field, that all businesses and bad actors don't have, you know, all businesses continue to work on a level playing field, so that both workers and businesses can be protected.
Yeah, you know, you talk about the unemployment system. There was that backlog mm-hmm. early on in the pandemic. There's debate mm-hmm. in the legislature over how to fix it, but there's also this debate as to whether people who are receiving unemployment benefits are not looking for work because they can receive more money via unemployment. What do you think of that debate?
I don't think it's a debate we should be having, considering if someone is able to make more on unemployment and take care of their families and receive these benefits, then the businesses that were operating with lower wages most likely should not have been operating in the first place. If you can't care for your workers and you can't care for your employees, you probably shouldn't have them.
We're talking with State Representative Francesca Hong, first-term Democrat in the Assembly representing a Madison district, and we're talking about the restaurant industry. You can join in. Do you work in the restaurant industry? What would help you in terms of the state and providing resources at this time? 800-642-1234. You have a proposal that calls for an end to the tipped minimum wage, which is now $2.33 an hour. For employees younger than age 20, the wage can be as low as $2.13 an hour. What would your proposal do?
So this bill that I introduced with Senator Chris Larson would eliminate the tips of minimum wage. So this is $2.33 and $2.13 an hour. And it raises it to the current minimum wage, which is still too low, but it raises it to $7.25 an hour. This will give some businesses kind of a way to kind of ease into raising wages. We know that many of the costs that go into operating restaurants have also increased, whether that be your to-go boxes, some of the services that are being offered, maintenance, et cetera. And so in order to slowly meet some of those costs without having to raise prices right away, this bill would allow for those to not have to be reliant on, you know, am I going to go in and make $50 in tips today or $100, or am I going to make $10? It gives people a little bit more stability. But again, it's not enough, but this is a good first step that we can take.
What happened at your restaurant? You know, using that as a case example here, what happened at your restaurant when you went to $15 an hour wages for employees?
We're very fortunate to have a strong and stable team that, you know, we've had very little turnover since we opened. We've taken a lot of care. We weren't able to start with $15 minimum wage, but we were able to offer it this past year. We have not had very little turnover, and to be honest, we've had very little trouble finding new employees as we get ready to reopen our patio and reopen for service.
Could paying tipped workers the standard minimum wage, would that hurt some financially by reducing their income from tips?
It depends on the restaurant.
Okay.
It depends on the type of restaurant. It really does. I think you'll find with some of the more fast casual restaurants that folks will see an increase to their take-home pay. I think for some in the industry, particularly bartenders or servers who are more in fine dining, seeing the tips split across the different sectors, the different departments in the restaurant, you might see a lower of take-home pay for a weekly basis, but you, again, are adding to the stability, right? We want to make sure that we're making our industry more of a career and not just a stepping stone for folks. And if we want to do that, we have to be competitive with higher wages.
And it's interesting too, because as you well know, the back of the house has to be aligned with front of house. They have to work mm-hmm. together. It's just not one or the other.
Right. It's very important that we understand that every single person in the restaurant ecosystem as well is an essential worker. And so regardless if you're washing, the person who is washing dishes is just as important as the first person you see when you walk into the restaurant as a host. And it's incredibly important that when you're in a high stress job as a restaurant, when you're putting yourself last, when you're centering the customer that's coming in, that you have a team that supports you to do that. And if we can create that environment even more by making sure that we have stable wages for everyone, you know, it becomes less emotional labor. There's not as much emotional stress that goes into the work, and hopefully we can become a much more sustainable industry.
How might customers notice or not notice whether a restaurant is, paying minimum wage or the sub-minimum?
I think it's absolutely okay for customers to ask. And I think you'll notice if there are service charges on the receipt, restaurants have to market themselves. Now you see stronger social media programs. People are being very, very open about, what they're supporting, what their wages are. And I think that trend needs to continue. I think restaurants do need to be transparent about their workplace practices, and customers really should be looking at where they're dining and if their dining places are the ones that want to support them because they support their workers.
We're talking with Democratic Representative Francesca Hong of Madison. Should the tipped minimum wage be eliminated, or do you think that would lower tips and take-home pay for servers and other tipped employees? Join in the future of the sub-minimum wage, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with Representative Hong here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the future of the sub-minimum wage and a bill introduced by Representative Francesca Hong last month to eliminate it. If the bill succeeds, Wisconsin would join 7 other states, including our neighbor Minnesota, by the way, requiring employers to pay tipped employees full state minimum wage before tips. That's state-by-state analysis from the Labor Department. Are you a restaurant owner? How would your business be affected by this bill? Do you worry you'd lose your best wait staff? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. And Representative Francesca Hong is with us for 10 more minutes. Representative Hong, what have your fellow lawmakers said about this bill as you show it to them and you look for support?
Many lawmakers are quite supportive, especially in the Democratic caucus. They know that a lot... the restaurant industry, like many industries, has been built on the exploitation of workers and institutional racism. And I think a big step that we can take in terms of combating this systemic racism is really making sure to eliminate practices like tipping and try to figure out ways that we can constructively rebuild the industry to be more equitable for folks.
Laura from Madison called in, couldn't stay with us. Laura says they know rural people mm-hmm. in rural areas who never tip because they have no idea people don't make the $7.25 minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Hong, what do you think of that?
I think it's incredibly unfortunate. Again, inadequate wages and the fact that we're exploiting people to be able to do a job that I think so many often don't don't think about the workers, right? Because you go to a restaurant to have a wonderful experience, and that's really our job, is to make sure that experience is a good one, that we're connecting people with food and a good social atmosphere. But at what cost? And then regardless of we're in rural areas or urban areas, we need to be treating all workers with dignity and fair wages. And it doesn't matter the job that you're doing, each one is deserving of a fair wage.
Let's look at minimum wage for a moment. Governor Evers has proposed raising it to $10.50 by 2023. He would also create a task force to look at raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour eventually. Do you think these proposals go far enough?
No. We know that with the rate of productivity, our minimum wage right now should be closer to $24 an hour. We haven't raised the minimum wage in over 12 years. If we are going to have a robust economy, if we're going to invest in workers and make sure that we're investing in our communities, that has to start with wages. And establishing a task force, while I'm sure is well-intentioned, is not going to be enough and is not going to provide the meaningful action that we need. And if it doesn't happen at the state level, I anticipate it to happen at the federal level, and we'll be continuing to push for that to happen as well.
Let's go to Tim now, who's joining us from Mount Sterling. Hi, Tim. What would you like to add on this issue?
Good morning. So the senator said that she's paying $15 an hour right now to her team members, but she's calling for what she thinks should be $24. So earlier she mentioned that if people aren't paying higher than a minimum wage, they're not running a sustainable business. So my question is, if you think it should be $24, why are you not paying $24 right now?
I didn't say that I think it should be 24 right now. I appreciate the question very much. I would like for us to build up to that. It's not something that we can kind of turn on the switch overnight and make everyone be on board with it. We know that some of these things take time, which I think was the thought that the governor had put in to his budget proposal. However, we know that that's what it should have been had we followed the rate of productivity. And so what this has done is created vast income inequality. And so those who have been making less continue to make less, and really it gets more and more difficult for folks to be able to access jobs with better wages. And we want the restaurant industry to become one of those industries that where people can access better wages. And so I think if we continue to really exploit workers, especially with a subminimum tipped wage, and to rely on tips, it's not going to be sustainable for a thriving restaurant industry. And we know that a thriving restaurant industry is what many of our communities want.
Opponents say raising the minimum wage, they've called it a job killer that would hurt workers, lead to more automation. How do you respond to those arguments?
It's automation is one of those that I think is kind of a separate conversation to have. In the restaurant industry, we know that we're seeing more people go towards fast casual, which for me does bring up some red flags in terms of us not having to rely on workers. But I think when we talk about being a job killer, we have to step back and remember that, a lot of what we did what happened with the pandemic is that a lot of these folks who were working lower wage, minimum wage jobs, either they still had to continue to go to work in very hazardous working conditions, or they were out of work altogether. And to expect all of a sudden, when we had women leave the workforce by the millions, when you had lower wage, especially service industry workers, not have access to benefits, to all of a sudden have the capacity and the infrastructure within their homes to be able to just come back to work, that's not the reality. But the reality of what we can do as employers and as policymakers is continue to protect and create better working conditions, to invest in workers so we can have a stronger economy. It doesn't make sense that we invest or we allow rich people to invest in larger properties or larger developments, and that we can't, as policymakers, invest in people. And that's what we need to do to be able to move forward, to make sure that we're not hitting the dangers of automation, and that we continue to make a strong workforce for the restaurant industry.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with State Representative Francesca Hong, a first-term Democrat who represents a Madison district. Switching gears here, you're co-sponsoring an economic justice bill of rights. What would this bill do?
This is a resolution that is a commitment to the people of Wisconsin that we recognize as Democrats that we do not have the majority. We don't have the power that we would like in terms of policymaking, but we do know that that power still rests with the people of Wisconsin. So it's our commitment to them that we know, and this is a strong message, right? I think it's very important that as a caucus we think about what our message is to the people of Wisconsin to let them know that regardless of the power and the politics that the Republicans continue to play, that we are on their side. So it is a commitment that we know that every Wisconsinite has a right to clean water, to affordable housing, to affordable health care, to high quality education, to live free of discrimination, to high quality, clean public transit, and the right to collectively bargain. These are the commitments that we are making to the people that we're going to continue to fight for as long as we're in office.
So 10 principles, it seems like a mm-hmm. pact almost. What is the practical effect of having them enacted as law?
So again, this is then showing that, you know, economic security is so key for folks to have agency to be thriving in their communities. And we know that in order to get economic security, we have to bring justice into the equation. We have to bring climate justice into the equation. And so once they're enacted, it really is to provides us with this framework, right? This vision that each one of these pillars and these commitments is what Wisconsinites need to be able to have the agency to move forward as citizens and not be kind of beholden to the power and the politics that a lot of our Republicans are playing right now.
One of the principles is access to health care. The governor has called a special session for tomorrow seeking the legislature to expand Medicaid. Republicans have continually responded to this as a no. What do you expect will happen tomorrow?
I don't expect much. I believe the plan is to gavel in and gavel out. And it's a damn shame that not only do lawmakers in Wisconsin not want over 90,000 people to have access to quality health care, but the fact is they're putting $1.6 trillion $1 billion that we would have access to be able to provide funding for so many needed programs in this state to combat homelessness, to make sure that we're mitigating PFAS for a Hmong cultural center, that we're building the cultural literacy that we want our students to have. You know, the job security that we could help people get, the investments that we need in so many of the agencies that Republicans have defunded over the past 10 years, that access to that money is being obstructed and blocked by colleagues and putting Wisconsin lives and livelihoods at risk is quite atrocious.
What have you heard in the last few seconds in your district in terms of expanding Medicaid?
There are, you know, as someone who was on Badger Care when I was pregnant, as someone who knows how important these programs are, especially to some of those in the service industry, who have not had access to healthcare in the past, it's a vital service that needs to be expanded and needs to be reworked a little bit too. We know that Badger Care is not the stopgap fix all for everything, but again, to deny people healthcare in a time where we know that just because the pandemic is you know, slowly fit going into a different stage, that doesn't mean that we can't be investing in healthcare for all Wisconsinites right now.
Representative Hong, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Kate.
State Representative Francesca Hong is a first-term representative in this assembly from Madison and a chef and co-owns Morris Ramen in Madison. Just ahead, we talk with a veteran food writer about her new cookbook and her efforts to embrace local food sources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.